From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, on alert, President Vladimir Putin readies Russia's combat troops amid the ongoing political unrest in neighbouring Ukraine.
Very quickly announced by Vladimir Putin, using those emotive words, on alert, for his troops, especially in the western military district, which is close to Ukraine. Certainly very significant timing.
Also today, dramatic scenes in a British court as the two men who murdered a British soldier in public last year are sentenced, and billions owed. Two major reports show how wealthy individuals and corporations are avoiding paying their due.
You're governed by this country's laws, and yet you hide behind the Swiss law, and that's just simply not going to cut it.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The United States is planning to offer financial assistance to Ukraine, even as Washington warns Moscow against taking any military action. The White House is calling on all outside actors in the region to stay out of Ukraine and be transparent about their military actions. Meanwhile, as Malcolm Brown reports, America's top diplomat says Washington intends to offer a $1 billion loan guarantee.
The U.S. Secretary of State told reporters that there's an urgent need to provide assistance to Ukraine following the turmoil there. With Russian troops in the region put on high alert, John Kerry called on Moscow to be very careful, saying that any military action would be a grave mistake. In an interview with cable channel MSNBC, Mr. Kerry urged the Russians not to see this as a continuation of the Cold War, noting that Moscow opposes outside intervention in places like Syria.
Reports from Crimea indicate Russian-backed military volunteers have set up security checkpoints on the main road leading to the strategically important city of Sevastopol. A group of Canadian reporters say they witnessed at least a dozen men in military fatigues enforcing a checkpoint around the city that is home to Russia's Black Sea Fleet. Our Moscow correspondent Anya Ardaeva says tensions are mounting in Crimea.
Russian news agency Interfax reports that checkpoints have been set up around Sevastopol in Ukraine's Crimea. It also said that the city's borders were guarded by self-defense militia and police. The report said that Sevastopol's mayor, Alexei Chali, who is a Russian citizen, has ordered the checkpoints to be set up. The new mayor was elected during a mass pro-Russian rally in Sevastopol on Sunday.
One of the men convicted of murdering a British soldier outside in a street in London has been jailed for life. Michael Adebolajo and Michael Adebowale attacked drummer Lee Rigby near his barracks in South London last May in broad daylight. Adebolajo was given life in jail. Adebowale handed a minimum term of 45 years. Our correspondent Ollie Barrett is outside the Old Bailey Court in central London.
Emotions running high outside the Old Bailey, but inside the court, dramatic scenes. With Lee Rigby's family looking on in tears, both defendants fought with security guards and were removed from the dock. They were taken down to the cells and the judge continued his sentencing without them, saying that the murder of Lee Rigby had been barbaric.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The boss of Swiss bank Credit Suisse, Brady Dugan, which is accused of helping customers in the U.S. to conceal their accounts to evade tax, says he deeply regrets what's happened. A report by the U.S. Congressional Committee made claims against the bank, which has around 22,000 account holders in the U.S. Our Europe correspondent Jack Parrock reports.
The report claims that between 2001 and 2008, Credit Suisse allowed banking practices which facilitated tax evasion for its American customers, the assets of whom are thought to total around $12 billion. It's just one of 14 Swiss banks being chased by US prosecutors for allegedly hiding offshore accounts. The private banking division of Credit Suisse has put aside around $300 million to fight the case brought against it. The US Justice Department says it won't hesitate to indict if and when circumstances merit. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
Venezuela has selected their first new ambassador to the U.S. since 2010. In response, the U.S. State Department said they are open to diplomatic relations, but that Venezuela must first earn the trust of the U.S. From Washington, Andrea Arenas reports.
Maximiliano Arbeláez, who previously served as Venezuela's ambassador to Brazil, is the nominee. The announcement comes the day after the U.S. expelled three Venezuelan diplomats in retaliation for Venezuela's expulsion of three U.S. embassy staff last week. The U.S. State Department said that Venezuela's recent actions are making it difficult for both countries to re-establish diplomatic relations. Caracas accused the American envoys of supporting a violent anti-government protest movement that has been sweeping the nation for the past 2 weeks. Andrea Arenas, Washington.
The obesity rate among young children in the U.S. has dropped dramatically, a new report reveals. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say that the obesity rate fell 43% over the past decade. Researchers theorize that a drop in soda drinking, as well as an increase in breastfeeding, may have helped address the problem. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Russian-backed volunteers have reportedly taken up position on a main road into the Ukrainian port city of Sevastopol in the southern region of Crimea. This follows President Vladimir Putin's earlier decision to ready Russia's combat troops amid the ongoing political unrest in neighbouring Ukraine, home to some 7.5 million ethnic Russians. Mr. Putin ordered a test of the military's battle readiness following the ousting of former leader Viktor Yanukovych after months of anti-government unrest. An arrest warrant has been issued for the former leader, whose whereabouts is unknown. To discuss these fast-moving developments, I spoke to our Moscow correspondent, Tom Barton.
These kind of military drills of various Russian military districts, they're not particularly rare events. They do happen quite regularly. But this was a very, very quickly announced by Vladimir Putin. And using those emotive words, on alert, for his troops, especially in the western military district, which is close to Ukraine, certainly very significant timing, and it will do nothing to try and ease concerns over the fears mentioned by the new interim Ukrainian president of secession by Crimea or other regions, or of possible violence in different regions of Ukraine.
In Crimea, we're seeing a standoff between pro-Ukrainian, pro-Moscow protesters, supporters. What's happening there?
Yes, the ethnic makeup of Crimea tells a long tale of difficulty of war and strife throughout the centuries. But at the moment, we've got about above 50% of that population ethnic Russian or pro-Russian in their outlook. They have not been supportive of the overthrow of President Viktor Yanukovych. And they're waving Russian flags, not the Ukrainian national flag, even though the territory is an autonomous but still part of Ukraine's territory. And then we have about 12% of the population made up of Ukrainian citizens who are actually Crimean Tatars, and they go back centuries, their ownership of that territory, overthrown by the Russian Empire, very severely repressed under the Soviet Union of Stalin's in Stalin's time, and now we see them supporting Kiev and supporting this new administration, chanting the very slogans that were used on the Maidan protests in Kiev. Those two forces really ranged against each other outside the local administration in the local capital.
The recent political unrest has also cast some doubt over the future of one of Russia's naval bases in Crimea.
It has indeed. Viktor Yanukovych gave an extension to that lease to Russia to 2042. So it looked as if the base, which Russia rents from Ukraine, was safe until all of this happened. It's a huge naval base, and one of Russia's largest fleets, the Black Sea Fleet, is based there. There have been rumours that the Black Sea Fleet may have helped Viktor Yanukovych, or may be helping him, his whereabouts are still not known, to try and escape from Crimea, where he was last seen after fleeing from his presidential palace. But it's also a very powerful symbol in the region for the pro-Russians of Russia's protection and possible ownership of Crimea in their eyes, and of ethnic Ukrainians, who make up about a quarter of the population, and Tatars. It's a symbol of Russia's imperial past there, and not a very nice symbol as far as they see it.
You mentioned the Black Sea Fleet and what role they may or may not have played in Mr. Yanukovych's whereabouts, but what are the other rumours circulating over his current location?
The last that he was seen of him was in a town in Crimea, where he decided he would part with all but a few of his bodyguards and administration, and then he shot off in some cars into the night. And it was thought that he had tried to make two flights out of Ukraine, both of which were blocked. It's known that there are various tunnels and caves there. It was a centre for repairing some of Russia's submarines at one point in the Soviet Union. And so it's surmised that he might be down there. There's all sorts of rumours flying around as to where he may be. Any concrete sightings, though, still elusive.
Tom Barton in Moscow. This is FSN Reports. Britain's most famous courthouse, the Old Bailey, was the scene of drama today as sentence was passed on two men who murdered a British soldier in public last year. Drummer Lee Rigby was hacked to death in broad daylight, just yards from his barracks in London, as horrified onlookers watched. It was a crime that shocked the British public, and today two men who said that a commitment to Islamic extremism had led them to carry out the attack were sentenced to lengthy jail terms. FSN's Ollie Barrett was at the Old Bailey and he told Simon Marks what happened in court.
As the sentence was being explained essentially by the judge, both defendants started shouting, started fighting with the guards, and they were both removed forcibly by security guards from the dock. They were dragged down to the cells, shouting all of the way, fighting as well. As this was happening, Lee Rigby's family, many members of the family, were in tears, and you could still hear the shouts of the two men when they got down to the cells inside the court. The judge then said that he would like to continue with the sentencing in their absence and asked the family if they agreed with that idea. They did agree and sentencing continued, but it was certainly a dramatic end to a day in which we'd already seen the sentencing delayed a couple of times.
Now, there was a difference in the sentence that was passed on the two men. One was sentenced, in essence, to life without the possibility of parole, what's known in Britain as the whole life tariff, and the other to 45 years in jail. Why the difference in the sentence?
That's right. And the whole life term in the UK is very rare. And the judge said that he thought Michael Adebolajo's case was one of those rare cases which warranted a whole life term. This is clearly a very dangerous man. The judge also described Michael Adebowale as an enthusiastic accomplice. But he clearly felt that Michael Adebolajo, to whom he gave the whole life term, was the ringleader here, was the man who had sort of carried Michael Adebowale along with his enterprise. So the judge feeling that Michael Adebolajo is a more dangerous man and sentencing him, as I say, in one of those rare occurrences to his whole life in jail.
And all of this comes at a time when the concept of that whole life tariff being available to the judiciary is being debated in Britain.
That's right. And that is why the sentencing of these two men came a little bit later than it otherwise might have done. They were convicted quite some time ago now, but because it was suggested that one or both of these men might be affected by the possibility of a whole life term, and there was an ongoing court case relating to that matter, their sentencing was delayed so that judges could reach a decision on whole life terms. The decision was reached that whole life terms could be applied in applicable circumstances, in the correct circumstances, and so the sentencing went ahead, and as you say, Michael Adebolajo given one of those rare whole life tariffs.
And there were some quite dramatic scenes outside the court with far-right protesters demanding, in essence, that the death penalty should be available in this case.
There were several far-right groups outside court, and dozens, if not hundreds, of protesters. Very loud, very noisy. As a result, there was a very large police presence as well. There were barricades up. There was a police helicopter circling above too. These protesters, many of them call themselves anti-Islamists. They object to what they say is the Islamization of the United Kingdom, and they wanted to see the death penalty. Of course, there is no death penalty in the UK, so that was never going to happen, but they were calling for its return. There were cheers outside court from them when Michael Adebolaja was handed his whole life tariff. There were those among the protesters outside court who were visibly and audibly disappointed when they heard that Michael Adebowale would not be spending the rest of his life in jail.
Simon Marks talking to Ollie Barrett in London. Now, with tax filing season in full swing across the United States, two major reports released today show how both wealthy individuals and corporations are avoiding paying their due. The Citizens for Tax Justice tracked nearly 200 companies over 5 years and found some making billions in profits, such as Boeing and Verizon, paid almost none of that to the government. A new Senate investigation additionally alleges that Swiss bank Credit Suisse has helped tens of thousands of US taxpayers hide their money in offshore accounts, and that they're just one of hundreds of banks to do so. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein has the details.
The Senate Subcommittee on Investigations said Tuesday that violations of the laws currently on the books are extensive and egregious. At a hearing on Capitol Hill, Michigan Democrat Carl Levin grilled executives from Credit Suisse, one of hundreds of banks found in their investigation to be actively helping rich Americans evade tax laws.
You're governed by this country's laws, by almost universally accepted law, and yet you hide behind the Swiss law, even though you're operating here. And that's just simply not going to cut it.
The Swiss law he cited prevents banks from handing over information about their account holders, even for international criminal investigations. The Senate report found that Credit Suisse alone has at least 22,000 accounts for U.S. customers, holding more than $10 billion total. The vast majority of this was never reported to U.S. tax agencies, and the bank used code names, secret elevators, and hidden bank statements to shelter its users from prosecution. The investigation also found that Credit Suisse actively recruited these individuals to hide their money overseas and flew trained bankers to the U.S. on tourist visas to attend events frequented by the wealthy, such as golf tournaments in Florida. While the hearing mostly focused on the Swiss bank's wrongdoing, Levin also blamed the U.S. government for its uneven and halting progress on going after the Swiss accounts, which he said has left billions of dollars in unpaid taxes uncollected.
The Department of Justice can still use U.S. tools, including grand jury subpoenas and John Doe summons and U.S. indictments, to get U.S. client names from the 14 targeted banks and test Switzerland's professed willingness to cooperate with U.S. tax enforcement. The Department of Justice can still hold accountable the U.S. tax evaders and the tax haven banks that help them, if the department has the will.
The U.S. government has indicted more than 24 Swiss bankers, including 7 Credit Suisse bankers, for aiding and abetting tax evasion. But there's an ongoing dispute over their extradition, and they haven't yet faced charges. A tax treaty between the U.S. and Switzerland is currently waiting for approval from the Senate, but that agreement would only bring transparency to bank accounts opened after 2009, excluding the majority of current tax evaders. On the other side of the Capitol, a group of House Republicans introduced a bill on Wednesday they said would simplify U.S. tax law by collapsing 7 income brackets to 3 and lowering the corporate tax rate from 35% to 25%. But Robert McIntyre with the watchdog group Citizens for Tax Justice told reporters Wednesday that very few corporations are currently paying the 35% required by law. He explained what he found studying nearly 300 of the most profitable companies in the United States.
An awful lot of these companies are paying little or nothing in federal income taxes. Almost a third of them paying less than 10%, including 26 of them that pay zero taxes or sometimes even less. And some of those no-tax companies are Boeing, General Electric, Priceline, Verizon, the list is long.
The group calculates that hundreds of billions of dollars in corporate taxes are lost each year through special tax breaks and offshore accounts. Rebecca Wilkins, the senior counsel for Citizens for Tax Justice, said it's up to Congress to close those loopholes.
they should change the corporate alternative minimum tax so that it does the job it was originally intended to do. When it was enacted and reformed back in 1986, it was causing corporations to actually pay taxes for a few years, but then that lobbyist came in and got a lot of changes to the alternative minimum tax, where now it raises almost no revenue, and Congress could easily change those rules and get it back to where it's supposed to be.
Citizens for Tax Justice said better enforcement of corporate tax law would recover billions of dollars the U.S. government could use to undo recent painful cuts to nutrition, education, and health care programs for the most vulnerable families in the country. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
If there's no agreement, there'll be no NATO troops in Afghanistan after 2014. The message from the head of the alliance, Anders Fogh Rasmussen. This chiming with President Obama's earlier decision to instruct the Pentagon on the possibility of a complete US troop withdrawal from the country this year. To discuss the frayed relations between the US and Afghanistan, I spoke to Robert Zarate, Policy Director of the Foreign Policy Initiative in Washington.
President Karzai has refused to approve and put into legal force this bilateral agreement with the United States. And in fact, President Karzai has said that he's going to defer the decision likely to the next president. Afghanistan faces elections for a president in April 2014. There are about 11 candidates running for that. And so that's the second decision point, which is the choice of the Afghan people, who they decide to take Karzai's place. And then after that election happens, and I think everyone here in the United States who follows this issue hopes it will go through with no hitches. Once there is a successor to Karzai, the question will be how long it takes the successor to approve the bilateral security agreement. But I think what we see President Obama trying to do is increase the pressure on Karzai actually to change his approach and to actually approve the bilateral security agreement before the election.
Robert, can you explain, why won't Mr. Karzai put pen to paper on this?
A lot of this actually has to do more with the personal dynamics between President Obama and President Karzai. There has been growing acrimony between the Obama administration and the Karzai government for quite some time. You don't see the same sort of relationship that we used to see between President Bush and President Karzai. A phrase that you often would hear in the Afghan hand circles was, President Bush and President Karzai saw each other as swimming partners, which is to say they tried to make sure that neither one would sort of fall below the political waters as they were prosecuting this conflict in Afghanistan against the Taliban and militants and terrorists within the country. You don't see that same relationship today. I think President Obama in the last calendar year or last 12 months has spoken to Karzai only three times. That's in sharp contrast to President Bush, who spoke to Karzai almost daily.
Why is it so important for this administration to see a presence remain in Afghanistan after 2014? And what significance is it to the region itself?
Sure. I boil it down to three points: security, prosperity, and human dignity. Security. Afghanistan, without Afghanistan, the United States could not have found and eliminated Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. So Afghanistan provides, if you will, a platform from which the United States, especially its special forces, can prosecute its conflict against terrorists in the region. Second, Afghanistan is important because whatever gloom and doom one sees in the news, there are glimmering points of hope in Afghanistan. You see the emergence right now in Afghanistan of the first generation of young adults who actually had high school educations in non-Taliban environment. And within Afghanistan itself, you see a very vibrant and excited political culture. You know, as I mentioned, there are 11 candidates right now. And you know, I have Afghan friends who've recently come back from Kabul, and they said there's just a huge market difference, that everyday Afghans are very energized for the upcoming elections. And then last, you know, over the long term, if the United States doesn't stay in Afghanistan, Afghanistan will, you know, which is doing better than it did under the Taliban, will have a hard time recovering economically and building up what hope people hope eventually will be a more vibrant economy. In fact, you're seeing Afghan business owners. They're actually hesitant right now to invest in their own country until they know what the security situation will look like after 2014.
Robert Zarate, Policy Director of the Foreign Policy Initiative in Washington. And finally, it's a trend that's changing the face of fashion marketing and the online equivalent of gushing to a friend about a recent shopping spree. Haulers film and post videos on YouTube showing off what they've bought at the mall. While watching them might not be everyone's idea of entertainment, the most successful videos have clocked up millions of views. Retailers are now approaching haulers to promote their products, aware that the casual peer-to-peer tone of their work makes them seem more authentic than regular ad campaigns. And as Rebecca Bowring reports from San Francisco, one Northern Californian teenager called Bethany Motta, or Mac Barbie 07, is building a fashion empire off the back of her home videos.
Hey guys, so today I'm going to be doing a haul video.
18-year-old Bethany Motta is showing off her recent purchases to an audience of millions. The charismatic Californian teenager's become a YouTube sensation since she started uploading videos of her shopping mall hauls 4 years ago. Not only is Mac Barbie 07 more popular on the web than Vogue magazine, she's also cashing in on her retail therapy. Motta's the face of a clothing and jewelry line at the American teen clothing store Aeropostal, which has struggled with poor sales growth and a falling stock price. Enter Motta and her legion of teenage fans, precisely the demographic the store hopes to get through its doors.
She can express the message of the clothes.
I can see myself wearing them and looking good in them, then I'm going to buy them.
The trend for hauling is transforming fashion marketing because the videos shot with web or handycams showcase the recommendations of actual customers. And it's the authenticity and transparency of the boy or girl next door that audiences appreciate. Clothing and cosmetics retailers can tap into the influence of these social media fashion gurus by striking brand endorsement deals, a potentially lucrative business.
London is good for many things, one of them being shopping.
British hall queen Zoella has partnered with fashion retailer Topshop to host their giveaways. Suze Barnes is a digital marketing consultant. She says haul videos are so popular because they're entertaining and have a real-life quality.
People respond to what their peers are posting, and people trust their friends and their peers much more than they trust advertising. So, you know, 90% of people will buy something recommended by a friend versus only 14% will buy something that's recommended through an ad.
The passion for fashion just keeps growing. There are now over 800,000 haul videos online. A 2012 Google study found 4 in 10 people who watched one then visited a store or a retailer's website. It's a good excuse, but I love to use it. Meanwhile, Bethany Motta's making hay while the sun shines. Her favourite hobby's now a million-dollar phenomenon, and her viewers simply love her. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of our programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Join us on Thursday for our usual look at the US headlines and news stories from our bureaus around the world. That's Thursday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.